Chapter 43. Laura soon discovered that there were three distinct aristocracies in Washington. One of these, nicknamed the Antiques, consisted of cultivated, high-bred old families who looked back with pride upon an ancestry that had been always great in the nation's councils and its wars from the birth of the Republic downward. Into this select circle it was difficult to gain admission. Number 2 was the aristocracy of the middle ground, of which, more anon. Number 3 lay beyond. Of it we will say a word here. We will call it the aristocracy of the parvenus, as, indeed, the general public did. Official position, no matter how obtained, entitled a man to a place in it, and carried his family with him, no matter whence they sprang. Great wealth gave a man a still higher and nobler place in it than did official position. If this wealth had been acquired by conspicuous ingenuity, with just a pleasant little spice of illegality about it, all the better. This aristocracy was aste, and not averse to ostentation. The aristocracy of the Antiques ignored the aristocracy of the parvenus. The parvenus laughed at the Antiques, and secretly envied them. There were certain important society customs which one in Laura's position needed to understand. For instance, when a lady of any prominence comes to one of our cities and takes up her residence, all the ladies of her great favor are in turn with an initial call, giving their cards to the servant at the door by way of introduction. They come singly, sometimes, sometimes in couples, and always in elaborate full dress. They talk 2 minutes and a quarter and then go. If the lady receiving the call desires a further acquaintance, she must return the visit within 2 weeks. To neglect it beyond that time means et the matter drop. But if she does return the visit within 2 weeks, it then becomes the other party's privilege to continue the acquaintance or drop it. She signifies her willingness to continue it by calling again any time within 12 months. After that, if the parties go on calling upon each other once a year, in our large cities, that is sufficient, and the acquaintanceship holds good. The thing goes along smoothly now. The annual visits are made and returned with peaceful regularity and bland satisfaction, although it is not necessary that the two ladies shall actually see each other oftener than once every few years. Their cards preserve the intimacy and keep the acquaintanceship intact. For instance, Mrs. A pays her annual visit, sits in her carriage, and sends in her card with the lower right-hand corner turned down, which signifies that as he has called in person, Mrs. B sends down word that she is engaged, or wishes to be excused, or if she is a parvenu and low-bred, she perhaps sends word that she is out at home. Very good. Mrs. A drives, unhappy and content. If Mrs. A's daughter marries, or a child is born to the family, Mrs. B calls, sends in her card with the upper left-hand corner turned down, and then goes along about her affairs, for that inverted corner means congratulations. If Mrs. B's husband falls downstairs and breaks his neck, Mrs. A calls, leaves her card with the upper right-hand corner turned down, and then takes her departure. This corner means indolence. It is very necessary to get the corners right, else one may unintentionally condole with a friend on the wedding, or congratulate her upon a funeral. If either lady is about to leave the city, she goes to the other's house, and leaves her card with PP. C. engraved under the name which signifies, pay parting call. But enough of etiquette. Laura was early instructed in the mysteries of society life by a competent mentor, and thus was preserved from troublesome mistakes. The first fashionable call she received from a member of the ancient nobility, otherwise the Antiques, was of a pattern with all she received from that limb of the aristocracy afterward. This call was paid by Mrs. Major General Fulk Fulkerson and daughter. They drove up at 1 in the afternoon in a rather antiquated vehicle with a faded coat of arms on the panels, an aged white wooled negro coachman on the box, and a younger darkie beside him the footman. Both of these servants were dressed in dull brown livery that had seen considerable service. The ladies entered the drawing room in full character, that is to say, with Elizabethan stateliness on the part of the dowager, and an easy grace and dignity on the part of the young lady that had a nameless something about it that suggested conscious superiority. The dresses of both ladies were exceedingly rich, as to material, but as notably modest, as to color and ornament. All parties having seated themselves, the dowager delivered herself of a remark that was not unusual in its form, and yet it came from her lips with the impressiveness of scripture. "The weather has been unpropitious of late, Miss Hawkins."
"It has indeed," said Laura. "The climate seems to be variable."
"It is its nature of old, here," said the daughter, stating it apparently as a fact, only, and by her manner waving aside all personal responsibility on account of it.
"Is it not so, Mama?"
"Quite so, my child. Do you like winter, Miss Hawkins?" She said Ike, as if as he had an idea that its dictionary meaning was prove of. "Not as well as summer, though I think all seasons have their charms."
"It is a very just remark." The general held similar views. He considered snow in winter proper, sultriness in summer legitimate, frosts in the autumn the same, and rains in spring not objectionable. He was not an exacting man. And I call to mind now that he always admired thunder. You remember, child, your father always admired thunder?
He adored it.
"No doubt it reminded him of battle," said Laura.
"Yes, I think perhaps it did. He had a great respect for nature. He often said there was something striking about the ocean.
You remember his saying that, daughter?"
"Yes, often, mother. I remember it very well.
And hurricanes."
He took a great interest in hurricanes.
"And animals.
Dogs, especially hunting dogs.
Also comets.
I think we all have our predilections. I think it is this that gives variety to our tastes."
Laura coincided with this view.
"Do you find it hard and lonely to be so far from your home and friends, Miss Hawkins?"
"I do find it depressing sometimes, but then there is so much about me here that is novel and interesting, that my days are made up more of sunshine than shadow."
"Washington is not a dull city in the season," said the young lady. "We have some very good society indeed, and one need not be at a loss for means to pass the time pleasantly.
Are you fond of watering places, Miss Hawkins?"
"I have really had no experience of them, but I have always felt a strong desire to see something of fashionable watering place life."
"We of Washington are unfortunately situated in that respect," said the dowager.
"Tea is a tedious distance to Newport. But there is no help for it."
Laura said to herself, "Long Branch and Cape May are nearer than Newport. Doubtless these places are low. I'll feel my way a little and see."
Then she said aloud, "Why, I thought that Long Branch, there was no need to peel any further." There was that in both faces before her which made that truth apparent.
The dowager said,
"Nobody goes there, Miss Hawkins, at least only persons of no position in society.
And the president." She added that with tranquility.
"Newport is damp, and cold, and windy and excessively disagreeable," said the daughter, "but it is very select. One cannot be fastidious about minor matters when one has no choice."
The visit had spun out nearly 3 minutes now.
Both ladies rose with grave dignity, conferred upon Laura a formal invitation to call, ate then retired from the conference. Laura remained in the drawing room, and left them to pilot themselves out of the house, an inhospitable thing, it seemed to her, but then she was following her instructions. She stood, steeped in reverie, a while, and then she said, "I think I could always enjoy icebergs as scenery, but not as company." Still, she knew these two people by reputation, and was aware that they were not icebergs when they were in their own waters and amid their legitimate surroundings, but on the contrary, were people to be respected for their stainless characters and esteemed for their social virtues and their benevolent impulses.
She thought it a pity that they had to be such changed and dreary creatures on occasions of state. The first call Laura received from the other extremity of the Washington aristocracy followed close upon the heels of the one we have just been describing. The callers this time were the Hon. Mrs. Oliver Higgins, the Hon. Mrs. Patrick Arail, pronounced O'Reilly. Miss Bridget, pronounced Breeze Arail. Mrs. Peter Gashly, Miss Gashly, and Miss Emmeline Gashly. The three carriages arrived at the same moment from different directions. They were new and wonderfully shiny, and the brasses on the harness were highly polished and bore complicated monograms. There were showy coats of arms too, with Latin mottos. The coachman and footman were clad in bright new livery of striking colors, and they had black rosettes with shaving brushes projecting above them on the sides of their stovepipe hats. When the visitors swept into the drawing room, they filled the place with a suffocating sweetness procured at the perfumer's. Their costumes, as to architecture, were the latest fashion intensified. They were rainbow-hued. They were hung with jewels, chiefly diamonds. It would have been plain to any eye that it had cost something to upholster these women. The Hon. Mrs. Oliver Higgins was the wife of a delegate from a distant territory, a gentleman who had kept the principal saloon and sold the best whiskey in the principal village in his wilderness, and so, of course, was recognized as the first man of his commonwealth and its fittest representative. He was a man of paramount influence at home, for he was public-spirited, he was chief of the fire department, he had an admirable command of profane language, and had killed several arties. His shirt fronts were always immaculate, his boots daintily polished, and no man could lift a foot and fire a dead shot at a stray speck of dirt on it with a white handkerchief with a finer grace than he. His watch chain weighed a pound. The gold in his finger ring was worth $45. He wore a diamond cluster pin and he parted his hair behind. He had always been regarded as the most elegant gentleman in his territory, and it was conceded by all that no man thereabouts was anywhere near his equal in the telling of an obscene story except the venerable white-haired governor himself. The Hon. Higgins had not come to serve his country in Washington for nothing. The appropriation which he had engineered through Congress for the maintenance of the Indians in his territory would have made all those savages rich, if it had ever got to them. The Hon. Mrs. Higgins was a picturesque woman, and a fluent talker, and she held a tolerably high station among the parvenus. Her English was fair enough, as a general thing though, being of New York origin. She had the fashion peculiar to many natives of that city of pronouncing saw and law, as if they were spelt sore and lore. Petroleum was the agent that had suddenly transformed the Gashleys from modest, hard-working country village folk into out aristocrats and ornaments of the city. The Hon. Patrick Arail was a wealthy Frenchman from Cork. Not that he was wealthy when he first came from Cork, but just the reverse. When he first landed in New York with his wife, he had only halted at Castle Garden for a few minutes to receive and exhibit papers showing that he had resided in this country 2 years, and then he voted the Democratic ticket and went uptown to hunt a house. He found one, and then went to work as assistant to an architect and builder, carrying a hod all day and studying politics evenings. Industry and economy soon enabled him to start a low rum shop in a foul locality, and this gave him political influence. In our country, it is always our first care to see that our people have the opportunity of voting for their choice of men to represent and govern them. We do not permit our great officials to appoint the little officials. We prefer to have so tremendous a power as that in our own hands. We hold it safest to elect our judges and everybody else. In our cities, the ward meetings elect delegates to the nominating conventions and instruct them whom to nominate. The publicans and their retainers rule the ward meetings, for everybody else hates the worry of politics and stays at home. The delegates from the ward meetings organize as a nominating convention and make up a list of candidates, one convention offering a Democratic and another a Republican list of incorruptibles. And then the great meek public come forward at the proper time and make unhampered choice, and bless heaven, that they live in a free land, where no form of despotism can ever intrude. Patrick O'Reilly, as his name then stood, created friends and influence very fast, for he was always on hand at the police courts to give straw bail for his customers, or establish an alibi for them in case they had been beating anybody to death on his premises. Consequently, he presently became a political leader, and was elected to a petty office under the city government. Out of a meager salary, he soon saved money enough to open quite a stylish liquor saloon higher uptown, with a faro bank attached and plenty of capital to conduct it with. This gave him fame and great respectability. The position of alderman was forced upon him, and it was just the same as presenting him a gold mine. He had fine horses and carriages now, and closed up his whiskey mill. By and by he became a large contractor for city work, and was a bosom friend of the great and good W.M. M. Weed himself, who had stolen $20, $600,000 from the city, and was a man so envied, so honored, so adored, indeed, that when the sheriff went to his office to arrest him as a felon, that sheriff blushed and apologized, and one of the illustrated papers made a picture of the scene, and spoke of the matter in such a way as to show that the editor regretted that the offense of an arrest had been offered to so exalted a personage as Mr. Weed. Mr. O'Reilly furnished shingle nails to the new courthouse at $3,000 a keg, and 18 gross of 60-cent thermometers at $1,500 a dozen. The controller and the board of audit passed the bills, and a mayor, who was simply ignorant but not criminal, signed them. When they were paid, Mr. O'Reilly's admirers gave him a solider diamond pin of the size of a filbert, in imitation of the liberality of Mr. Weed's friends, and then Mr. O'Reilly retired from active service, and amused himself with buying real estate at enormous figures, and holding it in other people's names. By and by the newspapers came out with exposures and called Weed and O'Reilly heaves, whereupon the people rose as one man, voting repeatedly, and elected the two gentlemen to their proper theater of action, the New York legislature. The newspapers clamored, and the courts proceeded to try the new legislators for their small irregularities. Our admirable jury system enabled the persecuted ex-officials to secure a jury of 9 gentlemen from a neighboring asylum, and 3 graduates from Sing Sing, and presently they walked forth with characters vindicated. The legislature was called upon to spew them forth, a thing which the legislature declined to do. It was like asking children to repudiate their own father. It was a legislature of the modern pattern. Being now wealthy and distinguished, Mr. O'Reilly, still bearing the legislative on attached to his name, for titles never die in America, although we do take a Republican pride in poking fun at such trifles, sailed for Europe with his family. They traveled all about, turning their noses up at everything, and not finding it a difficult thing to do either, because nature had originally given those features a cast in that direction. And finally they established themselves in Paris, that paradise of Americans of their sort. They stayed there 2 years and learned to speak English with a foreign accent, not that it hadn't always had a foreign accent, which was indeed the case, but now the nature of it was changed. Finally they returned home, and became ultra-fashionables. They landed here as the Hon. Patrick Rayland family, and so are known unto this day. Laura provided seats for her visitors and they immediately launched forth into a breezy, sparkling conversation with that easy confidence which is to be found only among persons accustomed to high life. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.